It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
SmackDown sucks. It's almost as bad as Raw.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
WWE dropped an early Thanksgiving gift in the form of eight more releases this week. Survivor Series Tonight is an appropriate name. If you work for WWE, every week is Survivor Series these days. We have a lot to get to. All of that, plus Randy Orton about to make history, Kenny Omega going away for a while, New Japan Pro Wrestling, and Noah. Pro Wrestling Noah making a big announcement. All that and more, this is episode 731 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 21st, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. With Turkey Day comes Black Friday, which means the annual Black Friday sale on ProWrestlingTees.com. You don't have to wait until Friday. It starts this Tuesday, November 23rd at 1 p.m. Eastern, ends the following Monday, November 29th. You don't need any coupon code. Get 20% off all of our shirts in the Sound Off store, including the new 14-year anniversary shirt. And again, no code is needed. Just shop between those times and you're good to go. ProWrestlingTees.com/SoloMonsterSoundsOff. And by the way, we've got a deal going with Ridge Wallet. When you use our link and our code for a limited time, you get 15% off. Not 10% off. Now it's 15% off your order now through December 7th. I've got a couple of Ridge wallets of my own. They're quality wallets. They're slim. They don't take up a lot of space in your pocket, which is what I like about it. Go to ridge.com/Solomonster and use the code Solomonster at checkout to get 15% off only for a limited time. And then it goes back to 10%. I mean, 10% is nice and all. But why get 10 when you can get 15? These wallets make for a great holiday gift, so I'm telling you the timing is perfect. So jump on that, ridge.com/Solomonster. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you can always do so, entirely up to you. TheSolomonster.com, you'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of that beautiful little page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out like these fine folks here. Let's do roll call. John Loose Cannon Lopez, one of our OGs. He's been with me since 2012. Episode 241. That's how far back he goes. So John, thank you. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Alsafar, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Pull No Punches, Alan Ragasa. Thank you for the very kind message, my friend. I'm very happy to hear that you are doing well. The Pastor of Pain, Damian Ewell. Thank you, sir. Thank you to Damian. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Ostentatious, Alan Carter. John Raging Mad Riffle. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, the Firebomber, Craig Foster, Dark Sky, Dixon Krasinski, Malevolent Michael Timoney, long time, first time, 7 years he has been listening to the Sound Off, so Malevolent Michael, welcome to the posse. Also, belated congrats, I want to make mention here of a good friend of the show, Lee Sanders. Congratulations on the 10-year anniversary of the RCWR show on YouTube, which everybody should check out. Congrats to Lee. Lee is good people. Speaking of good people, there were a lot of good people who lost their jobs this week. This month started with a bloodletting in WWE. 18 talent releases at the beginning of this month, including names like Keith Lee and Karrion Kross, who, in the case of Kross, relatively recently only first got called up to the main roster. Keith Lee had been around for a little while, but obviously he was sick and he was gone for a while. But two people who, when they were signed by WWE and they were made the NXT champion at different points during their run in NXT, people had high hopes for. People could look at a guy like Keith Lee or Karrion Kross and say, these are guys who could be upper echelon names on Raw or SmackDown in the future. These two have the potential to be stars on the main roster. WWE felt differently for them and 16 others. So that happened at the beginning of this month. On top of all of the other names that have been fired so far this year, including some pretty big ones, now you can add 8 more victims to the pile of bodies, bringing the total number of wrestlers released this year alone by WWE to 80. 8-0. You can fill the rosters of at least 3 or 4 different promotions with the number of people the WWE has released in 2021, which illustrates just how aggressive they've been over the past several years, signing talents, a lot of them just to keep them away from other companies like AEW. Talents that in most cases they had no real plans for. Just stockpiling them like weapons for some imaginary war. And a lot of these people are going to be better off outside WWE than they were inside. But there doesn't seem to be any real rhyme or reason or logic to a lot of the names that they have been cutting. For every performance center or developmental NXT name that maybe you, or even I in some cases, haven't really heard of, maybe they haven't made their debut yet. You know, it's sad when anybody loses their job, but it's like, all right, well, that person, you know, hadn't even had a match yet, whatever, you know, they're trying to trim some of the fat. That's very different than what we have been seeing over the past year plus in this company. It is a mix of not only those names, the lower level names, the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, but other bigger middle of the card and even upper card names that you look at and you scratch your head and say, how is it that this company saw no value or no added value for some of these people? How could they just let them go so easily? How could they debut them or re-debut them if they were gone for a while on television and then just poof, they're gone? Does one hand not know what the other hand is doing? The question is, what is going on behind the scenes in this company? Because it just seems like pure fucking chaos right now. And some people have no idea what's going on. People who actually work for the company have absolutely no idea what's going on here. You know, we hear a lot these days about the forbidden door in pro wrestling. With WWE, it's the revolving door. And out the door this week, when all 3 remaining members of Hit Row, just weeks after they were called up to SmackDown, only 2 weeks after they lost B-Fab, they now join her on the unemployment line. John Morrison, Johnny Drip Drip. I think it's time to call a plumber to plug up that leaky faucet because he's gone. Tegan Knox, Drake Maverick, Shane Thorne, and Jackson Riker. John Laurinaitis dropping the most dangerous finishing move in all of WWE on them. The budget cut. That is the go-to explanation they've been giving people, and this time around it was no different. It's just budget cuts, kid. It's just budget cuts. Nearly all of them, hired by or projects of, one Paul Levesque, who we got a glimpse of for the first time this week in 2 months since his cardiac event. He was looking a lot slimmer in a video that was shot of some of the executives touring the site of the new WWE headquarters that they're moving into later next year. It's only about 2 miles away from their current headquarters in Stamford, but I was amused by the sight of Vince McMahon wearing a WWE logo hard hat on the site. Everything has to have branding in this company. But I happened to be live on YouTube Thursday night when the news broke. We were celebrating the 14-year anniversary of this podcast. And thank you, by the way, to everybody who joined. We were having a good old time when the news broke of all the releases, and that sort of took the wind out of our sails. But I was kind of happy that I was live, because at least I was able to jump right into it and give my thoughts. But I wanted to spend a little more time on it here, because now we also have more information and more feedback and kind of their side of the story from some of the people who got cut. And we'll start here with all three remaining members of Hit Row gone. Hit Row became Death Row a lot faster than even I thought. I at least thought they'd have a few months before it would all come to a crashing halt. This was even quicker than I thought. They're setting new records here for how quickly they turn around and fuck all this stuff up. Isaiah Swerve Scott, Ashanti the Adonis, and Top Dolla, now Dolla General. Top Dolla, AJ Francis, it is worth noting, and I thought about this just like all of you. The first thing I thought of when I heard that Hit Row was gone from WWE, I thought of AJ Francis, and I thought of his tweet from the beginning of October when the announcement was first made about them being drafted from NXT to SmackDown. A lot of people were very down on it, not because they hated Hit Row. And this is the point that I made. If you listen to my NXT reviews every week, then you know that I was a big fan of Hit Row. I was a big fan of all four of them together as a group. I thought it was cool. I thought it was different. I was happy that Swerve finally had something to do after meandering around in NXT for so many months and doing nothing. So I was a big fan of Hit Row, and I had the same concerns that a lot of you had, and rightfully so. And by the way, every time we talk about these concerns, and then WWE turns around and does something like this, all it does is reinforce everything I've talked about here on this show, and why I am concerned when somebody who I like, or I think has a world of potential, gets picked to go from NXT to either Raw or SmackDown. Because, again, for every Bianca Belair or Damian Priest, who has found success so far, anyway, on the main roster, there are a bunch of other talented people, every bit as good as them, who don't. For reasons that don't make any sense. So, a lot of people were voicing concerns about it, and this apparently rubbed AJ Francis the wrong way, and he went on Twitter at the time and he said, "Stop comparing us to other people who couldn't transition to the main roster. We can promo. Thanks, comma, management." Now, if he would have gone on Twitter and said, "Look, I understand that, you know, you guys enjoyed what we were doing in NXT, but I promise you, you know, don't worry about it. We got this. We're going to go to SmackDown, light the world on fire, do NXT proud," something like that, there wouldn't have been any issue. But he goes and he says, "Stop comparing us to other people who couldn't transition to the main roster." There is a difference between being confident and being arrogant, especially when you're putting down other people. And he may say, "Well, that wasn't my intent, but people twisting my words." His words were plain as day. Especially when you are putting down other people who work just as hard as you did, if not harder, to try to make it to the top and to be a success in this company, and for whatever reason it didn't work out. Some people are going to transition to the main roster and it's just not going to work out. But in a lot of cases, a lot of these people don't get the opportunities that maybe they had in NXT, or that other people might have. Or they get a little bit of a push and then all of a sudden they get no TV time, and it's kind of hard to get over when you're not on TV. There's various reasons why a lot of people get called up and they end up being failed projects. But to say, "Don't compare us to them because, you know, they weren't good enough. We can talk. We can promo. We'll be all right." It was just a stupid fucking thing for him to say. And there were a lot of people who said, "That's going to come back to bite him on the ass." Now, I think at the time I said I give him 6 months. I think is what I said. So, again, I'm increasingly impressed by the swiftness with how WWE, you know, kind of nips these things in the bud. They took care of this a lot quicker than I thought they would. But I knew the moment I saw that he tweeted that this was going to come back to bite the guy. Top Dolla shot his mouth off and he got fired after wrestling exactly one match on SmackDown. It was a tag team match. That was it. And there's an old saying that applies here. Better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak and remove all doubt. It was a stupid thing for him to say then, and he looks even worse for it now. Look at Isaiah Swerve Scott. Shane Strickland, he debuted 2 years ago in NXT. Had a great run as Killshot on Lucha Underground. He was all over the place, I think. Lucha Underground, MLW. He was everywhere. He was a hot commodity on the independent scene, a very talented guy. He could wrestle, he could talk. So he signs with WWE. He debuts 2 years ago in NXT, about 2.5 years ago. Hit Row is formed in May of this year. He wins the North American Championship the following month, so already Hit Row is paying dividends for Swerve Scott. He then goes on to never defend it, and having pretty much the worst North American title reign of any of the champions they've had so far, through no fault of his own, before being drafted to SmackDown last month. Then he defended it finally, and he lost it. Or technically, he won, and then Carmelo Hayes, you know, cashed in his title opportunity and then beat him for it. But they took the championship off of him because he was going up to SmackDown. This all happened last month, and then on Thursday, he gets released. That is what they did with Shane Strickland. That was the life cycle for Swerve Scott in WWE. That is how the last 2.5 years of this man's career played out. If that happened in any other company, that promoter would be branded as brain dead. So please tell me what makes Vince McMahon any different than any other brain dead promoter who doesn't know their ass from their elbow when it comes to a talent like Shane Strickland. According to Meltzer, to go back to AJ Francis, he supposedly rubbed a lot of people the wrong way in NXT, and that was happening apparently on the main roster as well. He was getting a rep, I guess, for, quote, being difficult to work with or to deal with. And Meltzer says that he was the one that Vince McMahon saw as the star of the group because of his size. And that's something that PW Insider reported weeks ago before Meltzer even said that. Because it was PW Insider that said the plan was for Top Dollar to be the single star of the group, and it would be Swerve and Adonis penciled in as the tag team, which was the opposite of how it was in NXT. In NXT, Swerve was the star, and Top Dollar was tagging with Adonis, which worked better, I thought, the whole big man, smaller man dynamic. But the way Meltzer talks about it in the Observer this week, it sounds like once the decision was made to get rid of Francis because they didn't like him, and he was, I guess, annoying them, they saw no value in the other two, and they lost their jobs as a result. That's how that reads to me. And think about how absurd that is. I mean, all due respect to Ashanti the Adonis, you know, he was fine, but Swerve Scott, to look at these three men and say, okay, Top Dollar is rubbing people the wrong way, so we're going to get rid of him, and so therefore we have no, you know, interest in keeping someone like Swerve Scott around. We don't see the value in keeping somebody like him around. These are the decisions that these people are making. I want you to think about that and how absurd that sounds, especially after investing 2.5 years in this guy. That's what they thought of him. All along, the truth finally reveals itself that this is what this man was destined for. And if Top Dollar did not get released, Swerve Scott, yeah, maybe he would have had a job for a while, but he would have been somewhere down, you know, down the card or stuck in a tag team somewhere. That's where he would have been slotted. That is where they saw his value. Now, in his own defense, Francis has not gone quietly into the night here. He quote tweeted another website's coverage of the Observer report, what Dave said, and this is how he responded. Here's what rubs people the wrong way. Standing up for your own. When Brianna was released, that's BFAB, and I called the office myself to tell them that they made a mistake. Standing up for yourself. People in the PC told me Hit Row wouldn't work for 1.5 years, and I never took their advice. Trust me, I got plenty of stories I can tell about how I was disrespected, but just took it on the chin like a professional. Even with the video I released today, it was all professionalism. But I'm not gonna let these BS reports ruin my reputation. I got tea I can spill too. Now, what he was referring to there is a diss track that he released on Jinder Mahal. Since the last time we saw Hit Row on TV, I had thought it was the segment they did with Sami Zayn a few weeks ago. I had forgotten about the whole Jinder Mahal Shanky segment. I tried to block it out, maybe. Where they came up with their own cheesy rap on Hit Row, and Top Dollar went and released a diss track on social media that he later took down because I guess people thought it was insensitive, so I said, I have to listen to this. So I did, and I want to read the lyrics to you here. I mean, Solomonster always rapping is a great way to spend your Sundays. So credit to WrestlingNews.co for the transcription, so I didn't have to listen to it a second time and write it all out. But here's what Top Dollar had to say in response to Jinder Mahal that I guess people thought was insensitive in some way. To all you lames, you'd rather stay in your lane than play these games. Maharaja means prince, and you ain't that. The way you rap, it's clear you hate rap. I state facts. Ain't you the guy from 3MB? With COVID-19, you wouldn't be an ill MC. Good lord. You used to be a champion, and that's embarrassing. You're arrogant. And I mean, you're clearly a hater. I'd rather rap with Heath Slater. I'm like Curry from 3 when I'm grilling beef. Get it? Curry beef. It must be an emergency because... It must be an emergency because if you're spitting purposely, I'm Top Dollar... Your bottom rupee. If it was currency, I need a bit of urgency because Jinder's bars sound like he never heard the beat. Speaking of beats, I need to go and run it back. And then he replayed, I guess, the segment or part of the segment with Jinder and Shanky. What the fuck is that? Shanky, it looks like it hurts when you walk, and we can definitely tell that it hurts when you talk. This beef is looking like a walk in the park. Sorry, not sorry that I pulled the thread on ya. Sorry to start. And now just like that cloth, y'all is falling apart. God. I would have taken that shit down too. I don't see what's insensitive about it, though. I mean, but that's the world for you today. If people didn't have something to be offended about, they wouldn't know what to do with themselves. I don't know if I could top that, but we're gonna move on here. But Adonis and Top Dollar appeared on Busted Open Radio the other day. And hat tip to WrestleZone for this transcription. They had some very interesting things to say that I think are worth getting into here. Ashanti, this is what he said. This tells you, again, to go back to the whole chaotic nature of how things are behind the scenes in this company. Adonis said, Thursday morning was weird because we were booked for SmackDown Survivor Series and Raw, and then we were unbooked, and then they booked us again, and then we were unbooked. So I'm thinking, okay, this is what goes on in WWE. There's a lot of things to figure out. So I thought maybe they'll have something for us and we'll fly out Saturday or something like that. But I remember watching Thursday Night Football and I missed the call from John Laurinaitis. I called him back and he told me budget cuts and stuff like that. And I just told him, thank you. It is what it is. This company's entire creative motto is plans change. And yet people still bash Meltzer when he says plans changed. As if he just makes shit up for shits and giggles. I mean, sometimes he gets stuff wrong. Yes, he's not infallible, but... All the people who love to mock him and the whole, oh, plans change. As if plans don't fucking change in this company every day. You've got to be a moron to think otherwise. Plans change every day in this company. Here's yet another example of it. AJ added that they went to WWE headquarters recently and they had meetings about getting action figures. They would be a DLC in the new 2K video game. And he said, everything got pulled out from underneath us. He said WWE got mad that he called the office and asked why they released B-Fab. He says he told them B-Fab made them unique and that removing her made them just like any other three-man group, which is exactly what I've been saying. He also said they wanted to remix their entrance song without B-Fab, so they went and re-recorded it on their own, which apparently upset the company as well. He said, "We went in the studio and made a new song. I guess they were upset that we made a new song, but we're a rap group, so it's like, how are we a rap group if we can't make a song? Then we're just wrestlers." He said, "People want to bring up the fact about the song I released for Jinder and Shanky on Twitter that people got mad about, but Jinder himself not only loved the song, but said, and I have proof of it, that I said nothing wrong in the song. This is Jinder saying this. The whole point of it was the fact that we were in a feud together and we were trying to get more juice in the feud. Me and Jinder are cool. That was the whole point of it. When people are like, oh, the best he used... or the beat he used, rather, was insensitive. The beat that I used is called Beware by Punjabi MC, the most famous Indian sample in hip-hop. And when I picked the beat, Jinder Mahal was sitting next to me in the locker room when we formulated the plan to do this. So it's like, for people to be upset with me and think that that's the reason we got fired is ridiculous, because even Jinder himself went and talked to them and was like, no, it's not like this, we planned this together." Now, he had posted those tweets about, I got tea to spill, and kind of teasing that there may have been some other shit that went down that he could talk about. He did mention to Busted Open a situation where he was preparing, I guess, for a segment on SmackDown. One of the three that they fucking had since they got called up. And he noticed that the audio was too high. And he says that he politely asked to turn the audio down. And while he didn't directly hear the response himself, something very rude was said on the headsets. And he said that it was bad enough that three other producers came up to him and apologized for whatever it was that was said, even though he never heard it himself. And he said that if he would have heard that and replied to it, he would have been labeled as disgruntled and aggressive and the angry black guy. So, and by the way, I can totally believe that that happened. But again, he says he didn't hear it himself. But why would three producers come up to him and say, shit, you know, sorry about that. It was probably, who knows who it was. Got Kevin Dunn in everybody's ears. He's probably sitting in the truck like the, you know, the fucking emperor over there. All of his logs around him, fucking moron. But anyway, that ends the run of Hit Row in WWE. What might have been. I don't know how far they would have gone. I don't know if Top Dollar would have broken out eventually as a single star, if Swerve would have gotten a shot to be, you know, Intercontinental Champion one day or something. But the point is, they had something special in NXT. And it took Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard and the geniuses in WWE, only took them a few weeks to completely ruin it and run them off. John Morrison. Another name, gone from WWE. And this is only a few weeks after his wife, Taya, who is Frankie Monet in NXT, was fired. So both members of the household gone and fired by the same company within a matter of weeks. Morrison hadn't really been doing anything recently on TV since Miz and he split up and Miz went off to go do Dancing with the Stars. And Morrison's been sitting in the back doing meditation sessions on TV because they couldn't figure out what to do with him outside of him still doing that dripstick shit. They have him running around with fucking water guns like he's 12 years old, hosting Moist TV and doing comedy. So naturally, they looked at him and said, well, we're not doing anything with this guy, and so we can just get rid of him. Now, what's shitty about this whole situation is that he and his wife had moved recently from L.A. to Orlando because she had to train at the Performance Center. She had to be based in Florida, so they moved from the West Coast to the East Coast, only for them to turn around and fire her. So you can understand why she would be so upset, and she went off on them on Twitter, and rightfully so. And she said, "Stop supporting a company that has zero respect for their talent. You love pro wrestling. Spend your money on the hundreds of other alternatives. This is wrong. Ethically, as employers, they don't care about us, the talent, or the fans." And later on, because people were tweeting back at her, you know, all the WWE sycophants out there attacked her. They went on the attack. Because apparently Vince McMahon slips them a check every week and pays them for their public relations defense. You would think these people were being paid by WWE. They're so defensive about them anytime somebody says something negative. So she was responding to people. She said, fuck them. My husband got fired. This is why I'm saying this. I'm speaking my truth. I'm sick and tired of people treating us like shit. In 2 weeks, we both lost our incomes. Before the holidays, I'm allowed to feel how I do. And she is 100% right. I mean, holidays are not. There's never a fun time for something like that to happen. But in this case, you had two people with two incomes in the same household losing that income. Now, they're going to go somewhere. They're going to do well. They'll land on their feet. But it's a shitty situation, and she has every right to be upset. And if she wants to go on her social media and vent and be upset, then she has the right to do that. Tegan Knox. Tegan Knox is an unfortunate case. Tegan Knox was beset by knee injuries, plagued by knee injuries her entire time with WWE. She was going to win the Mae Young Classic. They had her pegged, supposedly, to win the entire thing. That was when her knee exploded in the match with Rhea Ripley. I mean, it was a catastrophic knee injury. I can't even list all of the injuries just from that one bump out of the ring. And she was gone for a very long time, but she had reconstructive knee surgery and ACL surgery on both knees. And fought to come back, came back, was paired off with Shotzi Blackheart and called up to SmackDown. And of course, they had wins over the Women's Tag Team Champions, and yet they never got their Women's Tag Team Championship match. And then they split them up and they put them on different brands. And Shotzi stayed on SmackDown and Tegan went to Raw, never made a single appearance. And so if you're Tegan Knox, and I've said before, you know, when she got hurt the last time, I said, it's hard not to look at this woman and label her as injury prone. And if you're WWE, are you really going to feel comfortable putting her in a position, let's say on Raw or on SmackDown, where she is in the thick of things? She's in the mix with the Charlotte Flairs and the Sasha Bankses and the Baileys and the Beckys and everybody else. Or, you know, put her in the women's main event on night one of WrestleMania, you know, in a couple of years or something, and run the risk of her, you know, hurting her knee again. It's something that I'm sure was on their mind. And I question what kind of future she really had in this company and if she was going to be able to come back. To her credit, she fought like hell. She came back. And I'm sure it's demoralizing for her to put all that time and effort into rehab and to fight back and to come back and to get that call to come up and then just have it taken away from you. So it's just it's a shitty situation for her to be in. But I, you know, this is something that could have easily been predicted. If anything, I was shocked she got called up to begin with. I never thought they would even give her that. I thought they would just look at her and go, we can't do anything with her. She's too injury prone. Drake Maverick, he got cut. Was it last year or earlier this year? It might have been earlier this year. He got swept up in one of these big waves of releases and put that very emotional video out on social media where he was crying, and he ended up getting his job back. I mean, it created this groundswell, went viral, and it created this groundswell of support for him on social media, and he got his job back, and now he's gone for good. He ain't getting his job back this time, but I have to give him a lot of credit because obviously he knew that this might happen, and he put together this really well-produced video that he just had waiting in his back pocket, because even Drake Maverick knew that the hammer would eventually fall on him again, as it does with a lot of people in this company. He was smart enough to understand that. So when he got the call from Johnny Ace, he put a video up that was very well produced. Even John Cena quote tweeted it out to his however many million followers he has and gave him a lot of praise. And it was basically, you know, Rockstar Spud kind of giving a pep talk to Drake Maverick, you know, with the power of some very sophisticated editing here in this video, telling him, you know, stop crying. You're going to be fine. You're going to do great. Giving, you know, trying to lift his spirits. It's worth going out of your way to watch. It's about 3 or 4 minutes long, but obviously he thought what a lot of people thought, which is that this was inevitable, and he was going to get cut again, and that's exactly what happened. Shane Thorne was done. The moment that he was rebranded as Slapjack. You can't rebrand somebody as Slapjack and expect them to stick around for very long. Honestly, his goose was cooked the minute that his tag team partner decided he wanted to go back to Australia. And that really was the beginning of the end for Shane Thorne. He stuck around longer than I thought he would. But the moment he became Slapjack, his career was done in this company. And then Jackson Ryker, I can't say that that really bothers me all that much. I was never really, a big fan of any of the Forgotten Son shit they were doing with him and the other two guys in WWE. Although the other two, I think, could have been a perfectly capable tag team on SmackDown. Another act that got called up to the main roster and was immediately just like Sanity. I mean, you can now put Sanity, the Forgotten Sons, and Hit Row pretty much all on the same list. It is a cautionary tale if you are part of a group getting called up to the main roster. Adam Cole made the right decision bailing on this company when he did, because he knew even if Undisputed Era had stuck around and had been kept together and not broken up, there was no future for them on that main roster. Even he was smart enough to see that. I hope Kyle O'Reilly is smart enough to see the writing on the wall for him as well when his contract comes due next month. But Jackson Ryker, you know, they tried to give him a little bit of a push, the stuff with Elias, and it was just fucking terrible. That was an inevitable cut at some point. Nearly all of these people, I made this point earlier, were hired by or pushed by Paul Levesque at one time or another. These were Triple H's people. I mean, outside of Morrison, who went right back to the main roster, these were Triple H's people. And the more of these people that get pushed out, the louder the message that it sends about where Triple H stands in the pecking order in that company. Brick by brick, piece by piece, between a lot of these releases and them blowing up his beloved NXT in the way that they have, they are erasing the legacy of Triple H that he has spent the last 6 or 7 years building. You may be of the mindset that that's a good thing, that him stockpiling all these indie guys and trying to create this big super indie was a terrible thing. And it was in many ways for the independent scene. And I told you it would be when he started doing that many years ago. But what he did was he put together this incredible collection of talent that made NXT a lot of fun to watch. Because yes, it was very kind of indie centric in that a lot of the people who were stars there were stars outside of WWE first. They had an established name. They were very experienced. Some of them came in literally with well over a decade of experience. But they still had some people on there that also were, you know, projects of theirs from the PC, whether it was Baron Corbin, you know, people like that were mixed in. And we had that sort of glory period of NXT there for a while. You may be of the mindset that them erasing Triple H's legacy and all of this is a good thing. Or you may think that that's a very bad thing. Regardless of what you think, you cannot deny the fact that it is happening. It can no longer be denied or deemed some kind of crackpot conspiracy theory. The proof is right in front of your faces. Open your eyes. This is what is going on. And I was left after I heard about all of this, all these latest releases, because I was thinking about where he's been. And I thought, what must Samoa Joe be thinking right now? Samoa Joe, who was fired by WWE earlier this year after working WrestleMania at the announce booth, only for Triple H to come in and say, you know, come work for me. These people don't know what the hell they're doing. I'll bring you back to NXT. And he re-signs. The company fires him and he re-signs with them under the NXT brand. And Triple H puts him back on TV. He ends up getting back in the ring. He wins the NXT championship from Karrion Kross. I don't know what the supposed medical issue was that necessitated taking the title off of him, if he is still dealing with a medical issue or if they're just trying to figure out what to do with him. The fact is, he doesn't fit in the new NXT. And obviously, he doesn't fit on the main roster because if they thought there was value in him, and they didn't see him as injury prone, they wouldn't have fired him. His injury history and his age work against him. So he's got to look at this, and what must he be thinking right now? He's thinking, I've made a terrible mistake, is what he must be thinking. I don't know how long that NXT deal is that he signed, but he's got to be looking at this going, what the fuck have I done? Little did he know when he signed that new contract, what would happen. Not just in terms of all these additional releases, but that Triple H, who believed in him, would basically be usurped. And NXT, as he knew it, would be blown up and turned into, fucking Teletubby show. So I don't know what his future holds, but boy, did he fuck up going back there. You could have had the triumvirate as free agents this year of Samoa Joe, CM Punk, and Bryan Danielson. Believe me, Samoa Joe, with his injury history, would have been a hot commodity and could have commanded top dollar from any promotion that he wanted to go to. And even if he can't work in the ring anymore, wants to wind down his in-ring career. There are a few people in wrestling today that are better on the microphone than Samoa Joe. There is absolutely a role for him, but clearly not in this company. The good news is that there is a whole world outside of WWE where a lot of these people can thrive. The beneficiaries are all of the independent promotions that now find this wealth of new talent available. Companies like AEW and Impact and New Japan. Look at Jonah Rock, the former Bronson Reed, being one of these people I'm talking about. He popped up last weekend at the New Japan Battle in the Valley show where he confronted Moose, and then he beat up Juice Robinson and David Finlay. Last night, he made his Impact debut at their Turning Point show. He destroyed Josh Alexander. He left him laying in a pool of his own blood. Now he's just going by Jonah. Whether it's John Morrison or Shane Strickland, Keith Lee, they're going to be better off outside WWE. This will end up being a positive for them because clearly they were on the road to nowhere there. But it also sends a message that this is really, you know, Impact may have had a turning point show, but this is a real turning point right now in wrestling. Because if you are a wrestler on the ascent, if you are a wrestler making a name for yourself on the independent scene, if you're a veteran working for some company outside of WWE, you have to be looking at what's going on and asking yourself, why the fuck would I ever want to go work for that company? WWE used to be the destination. Vince McMahon talks about the brass ring, reaching for the brass ring. Everybody wanted to go to WWE. Everybody wanted to main event WrestleMania. That was the destination. That's what you work towards. That's changing now. I don't see how it can't be changing. How could anybody in their right mind look at this, what's been going on here, and feel comfortable signing a contract with a company that won't even honor that contract? As one-sided as these contracts are, you can sign a 10-year deal. It don't matter. Tell that to the Good Brothers or anybody else who signed a 5-year contract or any kind of long-term contract. It ain't a long-term contract for you. It's a long-term contract for them so long as they like you. And the moment you fall out of favor with them or you outlive your usefulness, you're gone. There is no such thing in WWE as job security. So why in God's name would anybody even want to sign with that company and spend years there toiling away, wasting away their prime years is just beyond my comprehension. But more and more people have to be waking up to this fact. This week's podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Check them out at betterhelp.com/solomonster. We get our cars tuned up to stop smaller issues from becoming bigger ones, right? I think we all do. We go to the doctors every year for a checkup to make sure that, you know, the blood work looks good, there's nothing wrong. If not, by the way, you should. Therapy is no different. It is routine maintenance for your mental and your emotional wellness, two things that are very important, especially if you work for WWE. I can only imagine what their mental health must be like when they're on pins and needles and their phone rings, and they're afraid to look at the number that is on the display. But talking to a therapist does not mean something is wrong with you. It means that you're investing in yourself to keep your mind healthy. And as DDP used to say, that's not a bad thing, that's a good thing. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and live chat sessions with your therapist. So if you want to go on camera and see your therapist face-to-face, You have the option of doing so or not. The choice is yours. It's all about what you are most comfortable with. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours, all without ever having to leave the privacy of your own home. When you go to betterhelp.com/solemonster, you'll answer a series of questions to help match you with the right therapist for your needs. And if you're having problems, just know that there is someone out there who can help you. All you have to do is reach out. Why invest in everything else in your life and not your mind? This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Solemonster Sounds Off listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/solemonster. That's BetterHelp.com/solemonster. Tonight is the 35th annual Survivor Series from the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York, a show where most of the talent from Raw and SmackDown seem more interested in kicking their fellow brand members' asses than their opponents from the opposing brand, so much for brand warfare. You still have time, by the way, to enter the Survivor Series Pick'em Contest at WrestleRumble.com. You don't have a lot of time, though. 8 p.m. Eastern tonight is the cutoff. Enter now for a chance to win $1,000 cash for the first place winner, or $100 if you're the second or third place winner. All you got to do is buy an entry and then answer a series of prop questions about things that you think might be going down tonight on the show. So go ahead and give some thought to this, because these are some of the questions that can win you $1,000. How many eliminations, for example, will Seth Rollins have? How many eliminations will Sasha Banks have? How will the Becky Lynch against Charlotte Flair match end? Start thinking about questions like that. Enter now, WrestleRumble.com. You can walk away $1,000 richer. Last year at Survivor Series, Team Raw won a clean sweep over the members of Team SmackDown in the men's elimination match, which included Keith Lee, no longer with the company, getting the final elimination for his team. Roman Reigns beat Drew McIntyre in an excellent match. And with both men on the same brand now, that rematch should be coming very soon. And The Undertaker, on the 30th anniversary of his debut, officially announced his retirement in front of exactly zero fans. That was last year's Survivor Series. They finally announced the remaining champion against champion matches for the pay-per-view. It's nice to know they finally got around to doing that this week, including the tag team title match, which meant a surprise cameo by the Usos on Raw Monday night, who attacked Big E before Matt Riddle ran out to save him, and this led to, and I shit you not, this is what Sonya Deville said, she was making the unorthodox move of booking a tag team match on the spot, with Big E and Riddle taking on Jimmy and Jey Uso. Unorthodox, she said. Not only have they openly mocked the whole can they coexist stuff in recent weeks, now they're openly mocking how predictable their booking is. I've never seen a company so openly mock and ridicule and just make fun of their own terrible booking. I said this on the stream on Thursday. It's like they wear it as a badge of honor. They're proud of this. They wear it as a badge of honor. It's more like a dunce cap than a badge. But they wear it with a big cheesy smile on their face. That tag team match didn't last very long before it was turned into a six-man tag with Seth Rollins joining the heels, Randy Orton joining the babyfaces. Tonight, we have the Raw Tag Team Champions themselves, Orton and Riddle, RK-Bro, taking on the Usos, the SmackDown Tag Team Champions. There is trouble in paradise brewing with Orton and Riddle. Orton has yelled at Riddle for getting involved in business that doesn't concern them. The only thing Randy says he cares about is their team and the Raw Tag Team titles. But something is clearly going down soon between those two. I'm going with the Usos for the win. Let's just run through all my predictions here real quick. But let's be real quick. I'll be talking about this for the next 30 minutes. What am I talking about real quick? Let's be honest here. But I do want to talk about Randy Orton here for a second. Randy Orton tweeted an interesting stat the other day. Actually, he tweeted more than I've ever seen him tweet in one single day. He said, I've never been one to keep records or stats throughout my career. Early on, it was laughable to consider in my profession that you had, quote, wins and losses. You certainly wouldn't talk about it with the boys, much less the fans. But I'm fortunate to have some fans and friends that have done just that. They've kept my stats, not just wins and losses, but damn near everything that you could think of. It came to my attention that tomorrow at Survivor Series, I will set a new record for most pay-per-view matches by anyone in WWE history. The following night on Raw, coincidentally, if I have a match, I will have had more matches on Raw than anyone in history. I saw this online, I checked it, and it is true. Kind of hard to believe, as it feels like I only started down in OVW yesterday. I just want to take a minute in light of these stats and let everybody out there that's ever supported me in any way know that I am thankful. I also know with all my heart that I couldn't have done it without you. Now, on my way to his 15th Survivor Series, man, time flies, don't it? Indeed it does. Time does fly. Randy Orton, about to make history. I've never seen him as the guy in WWE. Maybe if John Cena wasn't around, Orton could have been the guy. But he's always been a step behind him on that mountain. But next year is going to be 20 years since Orton had his very first match on SmackDown. And Survivor Series has been his show. I have said if Shawn Michaels was Mr. WrestleMania, I've said that John Cena was Mr. Royal Rumble. Bret Hart was Mr. SummerSlam for me, although Brock Lesnar, could certainly claim to be Mr. SummerSlam as well. But Randy Orton has always been Mr. Survivor Series. He was the sole survivor for the winning team in each of his first three Survivor Series matches. And that elimination match in 2003, the Austin Bischoff match, that's a classic. And he holds the record for the most eliminations at Survivor Series with 16. So this is his show. And that's with him also having one of the worst matches in Survivor Series history against Big Show in 2013. The less said about that match, the better. United States Champion Damian Priest representing Raw battles the Intercontinental Champion Shinsuke Nakamura representing SmackDown. Priest has been kept pretty strong on TV. Nakamura, not so much. To me, it's just, you look at these two and who is really sort of, I think, preferred right now by the hierarchy in WWE. I'm going to say it's Damian Priest. I think he picks up the win here in this match. They've done nothing, by the way, to build this up. Outside of just the fact that one has a title and the other has a title. And it's kind of the way they did it, I think, with Sami Zayn and Bobby Lashley last year. It's just a match. There's no heat behind it. It's two baby faces. I think Priest gets the win. On Friday night, Sonya Deville acknowledged that Sunday would mark the 25th anniversary of The Rock's debut at Survivor Series, and so she announced that there would be a 25-man Battle Royal. And in the Battle Royal, we have AJ Styles, Angel Garza, Apollo Crews, Bobby Roode, Cedric Alexander, Cesaro, Chad Gable, Commander Aziz, Dolph Ziggler, Drew Gulak, Humberto Carrillo, Jinder Mahal, Mansoor, Omos, Otis, R-Truth, Ricochet, Sami Zayn, Shanky, some of these fucking names, Shelton Benjamin, The Street Profits, T-Bar, and the Viking Raiders. I look at that list, and the one name that stands out to me, the one I think is going over in the Battle Royal, Omos. He's my pick to win. We've got the Raw versus SmackDown elimination match with Team Raw, represented by Bianca Belair, Rhea Ripley, Liv Morgan, Carmella, and Queen Zelina, against Team SmackDown, represented by Sasha Banks, Shotzi Blackheart, Shayna Baszler, Natalya, and it was going to be Aaliyah, and Aaliyah was removed, and she was replaced by Toni Storm. That is an upgrade for Team SmackDown. They did a match on SmackDown Friday night between Sasha Banks and Shotzi Blackheart. They've had issues with each other. Shotzi obviously beat up Sasha weeks ago as part of her heel turn and blamed Sasha for costing her, her match against Charlotte. So they went at it, and then when it was over, Sonya Deville had told them they have to shake hands, which they did, and then Sasha promptly gave Shotzi a backstabber, so we already know those two don't get along. And that really is about all they've done to build this matchup in any kind of significant way. I'm going with Team Raw for the win. I think it's the team of Bianca and Rhea and all of them. I think the ladies from Raw are going to pick up the win this year. We have the men's Raw versus SmackDown elimination match with Team Raw, represented by Seth Rollins, Finn Balor, Kevin Owens, Bobby Lashley, and Austin Theory, replacing Rey Mysterio, against Team SmackDown, represented by Drew McIntyre, Jeff Hardy, King Xavier Woods, Happy Corbin, and TBA, because Sami Zayn was removed after losing to Jeff Hardy last week. So then on my anniversary stream on Thursday night, you remember, I did my initial predictions for Survivor Series, and I said Sheamus was my prediction for the final slot. Well, guess who won the game? I'd like to know what my prize is. What do I win? Sheamus won a fatal four-way on SmackDown over Cesaro, Ricochet, and Jinder Mahal to take the final spot on Team SmackDown with an assist from Ridge Holland. The two of them are now together on TV. Holland is a Sheamus superfan now. He said if it wasn't for Sheamus, he would still be broke and fighting on the streets back in Europe. Monday night, Rey Mysterio. To just go back for a second, because I said Rey was bounced from Team Raw. Rey Mysterio walked to the ring on Monday night. I mentioned this on Thursday, but I have to mention it again here, because, you know, not all the streams have the same audiences as the main show here. This is too good to not mention again. Mysterio comes out for the main event against Bobby Lashley. And I thought to myself, it seems to be very early for them to be coming out for the main event. I wonder what they're actually going to be ending the show with. And this is the perfect illustration of what I mean when I say that Monday Night Raw is just 3 hours of killing time every week. They could rename it WWE Killing Time. That could be the new name for the show, and it would be perfectly accurate. It was 10:30 when Rey made his entrance for his match. Then they go to commercial, and they come back with a video recap of what happened the week before on SmackDown. So that lasts about 2 minutes. Then they run down the entire card for Survivor Series. Then they recap what happened on Raw the previous Monday, with Lashley beating up Dominic to take his spot on Team Raw. Then Lashley finally makes his entrance, and then they cut to another commercial break. And then they come back to plug NXT the next night, and Raw Talk on Peacock. And finally, the bell rings and the match begins. 17 minutes after Rey Mysterio and his son first came down to the ring. That entire period from Rey's entrance to the moment the bell rang to start the match lasted longer than the main event itself. And then 2 minutes into the match, they cut to another commercial. I don't know how anybody could sit through that show in one sitting. It's more palatable if you watch it in bits and pieces, and even then, it still sucks. I cannot imagine sitting there for 3 hours straight every single week watching this show and not losing your fucking mind. You know, I heard a clip from the Major Figure podcast from a couple of weeks ago with Matt Cardona and Brian Myers, and they told a story about how much Vince McMahon loves texting. Because Cardona texted a photo to Vince recently, and he replied back with two smiley emojis. He kind of joked that he and Vince text more now that he's no longer with the company than they did when he actually worked there. So we know that Vince McMahon likes sexting, texting. But Myers said one time Bobby Roode asked him to watch Vince in Gorilla, because he was going out to wrestle. He goes, "Keep your eye on Vince while I'm out there having my match." Because he wanted to know if Vince McMahon was going to be, you know, watching his match. And when Roode came back, Myers told him, dude, there's no way he saw any of that. He was looking down at his phone the entire time. So even Vince McMahon does not pay attention to his own show, which I think explains a lot. But Lashley ended up beating Rey the same way he beat Dominic, with the Hurt Lock. And Adam Pearce walked out while Rey was being tended to by, you know, medics and officials, and He said that Ray was off Team Raw at Survivor Series and would be replaced by a name to be determined later. And this was the final Raw before the pay-per-view, by the way, so I love the whole we'll figure it out later on thing. But then Austin Theory came out from the crowd, he gave Dominic the ATL, and Pierce was so impressed by this, he added Theory to the team in place of Ray. So to recap, Adam Pierce was filled with regret 2 weeks ago about including Dominic Mysterio on Team Raw. Because he realized, all of a sudden he realized, every other member of this team is either a former WWE champion or a former Universal champion. So he booked him in a match with Lashley, which he lost, and he booted him off the team. He did all of that only to take Rey Mysterio out of the match and replace him with Austin Theory, who's basically a rookie on this show. Someone who has never held a single championship of any kind in this company. Austin Theory is a future champion. I'm all for getting new faces over in a Survivor Series match. I think that's fine. But the lack of any kind of consistent logic on this show is something that they really should win an award for. Kevin Owens beat Finn Balor with a stunner on Monday. He is, in fact, acting like a heel now. I thought what happened last week wasn't meant yet to be a full-on heel turn, but he's a heel. And he cut a promo talking about how he's going to break bad on everybody. Fucking Heisenberg here. Kevin Owens is breaking bad on the Raw roster. They should bring back, they should bring back Logan Paul to be his Jesse Pinkman so he can boss him around. Because Aaron Paul doesn't want to have anything to do with any of this shit. So the Raw team, you look at them, it's far more stacked. A lot of former champions on there. I mean, SmackDown has former champions too, with Drew and Sheamus, Jeff Hardy. But I'm picking Team SmackDown for the win, with Drew McIntyre standing tall as the sole survivor. That's my prediction. Raw Women's Champion Becky Lynch challenges the SmackDown Women's Champion, Charlotte Flair. I do think that we will have a decisive winner here. I know a lot of people are thinking, screw job, we're going to have another Survivor Series screw job. And maybe we will, and I'll fucking groan when we do. But I'm going to go with Becky Lynch as my pick. On Raw Monday, she cut this great babyface promo on Charlotte, only to flip the switch back to heel mode when Liv Morgan came out. It's just very awkward. This entire match is based entirely off the supposed real-life heat that these two women have with each other. And are they going to shoot? Is somebody going to go off, you know, off script? You know, it's like, reminds me of that WCW pay-per-view where Russo, literally in the copy, in the narration in the commercial, will go, you know, Goldberg didn't follow the script. They may as well have a commercial for this match, you know? Are these women going to follow the script? Are they going to shoot on each other? Spoiler alert, the answer is no. But Becky was on Ariel Helwani's show and was asked about the incident with Charlotte Flair, which I've already talked about. I'm not getting into the whole belt fiasco again, dropping belts on the fucking floor. It's over and done with. It was clearly a very real situation that happened. Words were exchanged. They're not as close in real life as they used to be. Charlotte admitted as much months ago, months before Becky even came back to TV and they even thought about doing this storyline. She had already mentioned that the two of them were not as close as they used to be. They are very clearly using that now to promote the match tonight, and that's fine. But the fact that Becky was stumbling over herself in some parts of this interview, it's very clear that she is not totally comfortable talking about all of this stuff. The same applies to Ric Flair. When Ariel asked her about some of Ric's recent comments, he had, you know, because Ric Flair has poked his head out recently from the sand. At least this time it's not the other head that he's poking out. Flair had tweeted something about there not being enough choreography in the world to save Becky in her match with Charlotte. Becky said that she wrote out this long comeback and then thought better of it, and she ended up deleting it and not posting it because she didn't want to get into a pissing contest with the old man. She thought it would have been too biting. And her response is something that they should teach in a college course about how to verbally fillet someone without ever raising your voice or using any cuss words. Use the right words to make them feel like absolute shit about themselves, is what she did here. She is a master of it. Even as she stumbled around trying to tiptoe around the landmines and not get herself into any trouble. But what she said was, I saw the tweet, the one you're referring to, the one I'm kind of referring to, and I looked at it and I wrote out a response that would have been quite biting, and I deleted it and I let it go because I think it's really sad, because this is a legend at one point. Now this legend, 16-time world champion Ric Flair, is now jealous of me. That's cool for me, and he's now trying to use me to get clout to promote whatever he has going on next, because he has dug himself in a hole with other things. So I was kind of like, let him have it, because it's kind of sad, you know? It's kind of sad. Calling him a legend at one point is the most biting comment in that entire quote. And then talking about him digging himself a hole with other things. Clearly, that was a reference to the sex assault stuff from the Dark Side of the Ring episode that bubbled up again. Which is not something they would work into any kind of an angle. Not in WWE. Nor does Flair want anything to do with drawing any more attention to that. And it's the plane ride from hell stuff being brought back to the fore that led WWE basically to erase him. And stopped AEW probably from working with him, even though Tony Khan is very good friends with him. He's smart enough to not bring that shit show on his company right now. And then worst of all, in this quote that I just read, she called him sad. So when people were tweeting me and say, what's, you know, Solomonster, you're out of your mind. What's so bad about what she said? Where's the burn? Where's the burn? Pay attention to what she said and the way in which she said it. The worst part of it to Flair in what she said there in that quote is when she called him sad. And I don't think there is anything worse that you could say to Ric Flair other than maybe you are the father or I want a divorce. There's nothing worse that you could say to him other than calling him a sad old man. She knows how to push the right buttons. But as I watched it, it looked like she really didn't want to say anything about it to begin with. Flair responded, as he always does, by capitalizing the first letter of every fucking word of his tweet, which is amazing to me. So disappointed. I did this out of respect for you, Becky Lynch. And he attached a screenshot of a story from a year ago about him selling the trademark to the man, to WWE. It made you millions and it made me nothing. After 40 years of being the man, the company doesn't own it and neither do you. I will always be the man. Ask your husband. Becky was right the first time about deleting what she had planned to post originally in response to him. Her sniping with Charlotte's dad does nothing to get me excited about the two of them wrestling at Survivor Series, but it does make Rick seem like a sad old man in the way that he's responding here. Also on Raw Monday, when Liv Morgan interrupted, Becky threw it to a clip of Morgan from Talking Smack 4 months ago, saying that she would love to win the title from Becky one day, and that when Becky left a year and a half ago, she told Liv that, by the time I come back, you're going to be a champion. Well, she's back, and Liv still is not a champion. She said she had no idea that Liv would underperform so badly. She said, look, some people have it like I do, and other people don't, like you. I think the promo hit a little too close to home for Liv Morgan, and it made Becky look like a prophet. But if Liv Morgan ends up taking the title from her, it's a nice payoff to the story, and she'll have proved Becky wrong. But if she doesn't, oh boy. All it does is prove that everything Becky Lynch said in that promo was 100% true. She put this woman in her place with that promo, and that place is in the middle of the card in that division. I hadn't seen that Talking Smack clip before. That was something else. And finally, Universal Champion Roman Reigns, one-on-one with WWE Champion Big E. Finally, we got an angle to put some heat on this whole Roman Reigns-Big E thing on SmackDown Friday night. Big E came out as an assist to King Woods, and he went at it. He was brawling all around the ring with Roman, and they were beating up the Usos. And Roman ended up hightailing it at the end of the show. That was really the only thing they have done to put any kind of significant heat on this match. This match felt ice cold coming into tonight, and it's still pretty cool. Let's put it that way. But the question is, who goes over? You could have Roman Reigns lose because it's a non-title match. But you know what? As protected as Roman Reigns has been, and whoever it is that is going to ultimately get the win over him, whether it's Drew, whether it's Brock at WrestleMania, whoever it might be, I still, even non-title, don't think I would beat Roman Reigns here. It would be a nice feather in the cap of Big E. I think Roman Reigns is going to win the match. And my bold prediction for how Survivor Series ends tonight, I think we end up with a new WWE champion. And his name is Seth Rollins. Because Seth Rollins has that championship opportunity, that contract that he won. And we know that based on what they did with Carmelo Hayes in NXT, apparently now when you win a championship contract, you can just cash in and use it like a Money in the Bank briefcase. So that's my bold kind of out there prediction for the end of the show. Instead of just ending with, you know, Roman Reigns getting the win, oh, the heel goes over, I think Seth Rollins comes out to pick the bones and walks out with the WWE title. But there you go. That's your Survivor Series card for tonight. Maybe WWE is saving The Rock as the ace up their sleeve. Maybe all this talk about Rock not being there is just to throw us off the scent. 25th anniversary of his debut, Barclays Center, Brooklyn. It would get a huge reaction if The Rock showed up as a surprise. But that would seem to indicate that they would be planting the seeds for a Rock-Roman Reigns match at WrestleMania next year. And unless they've done a very good job of keeping this under wraps, it sure doesn't look like The Rock is going to be wrestling at WrestleMania next year. So I would not pin my hopes on him being on the show tonight. But join me live when the pay-per-view is over. I will be live on YouTube talking about all the good, the bad, and the ugly. So hopefully you'll come on by and hang out. And before I go on here, I just want to talk about, on the subject of The Rock, and this being 25 years since he made his debut at Survivor Series. You know, as unimportant as this show tonight feels, 25 years ago this week was a pretty damn important and memorable Survivor Series from Madison Square Garden. Not too far away from where they're going to be in Brooklyn tonight. That, of course, was the night that The Rock, as Rocky Maivia, made his in-ring WWF debut. And some people knew, Pat Patterson knew, when he recruited him and told Vince McMahon, you got to sign this kid. Jim Ross knew on commentary that night. He flat out said, this guy's going to be the man. So there were people who knew from day one that this guy could go on to do some very big things. And obviously they started him out as a babyface, smiling babyface, and it backfired badly on them. But it all worked out in the end. It led to the heel turn that really set him on his course, him being part of the Nation and getting more and more comfortable on the microphone and coming out of his shell. And boy, was Vince McMahon lucky to have two stars on the level of Austin and Rock come along and get over at the same time that they did. I mean, that is just, every promoter in the world would kill to have two stars on that level working for them in their company at the same time. So him making his debut on this show is historically significant because of who he went on to become. And 25 years later, he's one of the biggest stars in the world. That was also the final Yokozuna appearance in a WWE ring. He was absolutely gigantic by this point. And they took him off the road. They wanted him to get his weight in shape. I mean, he was well north of 600 pounds by this point. A lot of commissions wouldn't even license him in certain states, so they really couldn't do anything with him. He was under contract with them, I think, for another year and a half, 2 years, into 98. But he never wrestled another match for them again. It was also the night that Bret Hart wrestled Stone Cold Steve Austin, their first of two classic pay-per-view bouts. Bret had just signed a 20-year deal to return to WWE. We all know how that worked out. It kind of reinforces what I said before about what contracts in this company really mean. You could sign a 200-year contract with WWE. They could fucking kick you out 2 weeks later if they want. But he signed a 20-year deal and went on to have not only a great match with Austin on the show. I like their WrestleMania match better. I mean, their WrestleMania match is one of the greatest matches in the history of that company. This one gets overlooked a little bit because of the WrestleMania one and because it was WrestleMania. But this is an excellent match that these two had. And if you've never seen the Survivor Series match before, you need to go watch it. You got to right that wrong. And I can't tell you, obviously, the significance of this match, of the WrestleMania match, to the career of Stone Cold Steve Austin. You talk about Rock debuting on this show and eventually becoming the star that he became. You know, I don't know about Steve Austin. I don't know if he reaches the levels that he reaches as quickly as he did were it not for Bret Hart. Bret Hart believed in him. Bret Hart advocated for him. Bret Hart wanted to work with him, requested to work with him. He won both matches, but certainly in that second match, even in defeat, it meant more to Austin's career than a regular pinfall win would have meant that night. People still have that image burned in their brains of him in the sharpshooter, blood pouring down his face, blood from a stone, you know, the whole thing. Cannot understate the significance of that feud and that whole program, that rivalry between Bret Hart and Steve Austin, which went on well into 97. It bled into the whole U.S. versus Canada thing. I mean, it was instrumental in the success that Steve Austin had in his career. And I do believe that if Bret Hart had not been screwed over and if Bret Hart had stuck around and not lost the WWF Championship at Survivor Series, the main event of WrestleMania 14, I mean, Shawn Michaels, much to his chagrin, I think the main event of WrestleMania 14, very likely, would have been Bret Hart defending the title against Austin. And this time, Bret would have put him over, and Austin would have finally pinned him and won the championship, and he would have won it from Bret instead of Shawn. He would have done the honors and put Austin over. That would have been the completion of their trilogy at WrestleMania 14. And of course, speaking of Michael, Psycho Sid won the WWE Championship in the best match of his career from Shawn Michaels on that same night, who was booed. He was booed heavily by the fans in Madison Square Garden, at least all of the male fans. And I gotta say, that match is actually a favorite of mine. It's not some kind of technical, you know, masterpiece or anything like that. It didn't have to be. It just felt like a big fight. And Sid was just over like gangbusters back then. But Michaels did not take the loss. He did not take the reaction that night very well. He wrote in his book that he dealt with it the way he dealt with a lot of things back then. He went out after the show and he got wasted. Shawn Michaels hitting the streets of New York City and getting shit-faced. So I just wanted to say a few words about that show here. 25 years to the week after Survivor Series 96. I remember where I was then. I was at my friend's house. Used to get he had the black box. Used to watch a lot of the wrestling pay-per-views there. I was at the same friend's house actually when Owen Hart fell to his death at Over the Edge. There's just certain memories that are seared into your brain that just stick with you. And this show is one of them. AEW followed up its excellent Full Gear pay-per-view with an equally excellent episode of Dynamite on Wednesday. Kenny Omega is going away for a while to heal up a series of injuries that he has been dealing with for much of the past year. That means he is out of the scheduled match with El Hijo del Vikingo at Triple Mania next month, where Omega was to have defended his AAA Mega title. He'll be having minor surgeries on his shoulder, his knee, and his abdomen. And per this week's Observer, he has been working with a torn labrum and an abdominal hernia for months now. He is hopeful to be back as early as the end of February, which kind of sounds optimistic to me. I mean, minor or not, I mean, when you're having surgery on three or four different parts of your body, it could be a while before we see him, but that's what he's hoping anyway. He had a great run as the AEW champion, but he was more than just AEW champion. With all of the injuries, he held the Impact world title for several months, and he helped give Impact its best pay-per-view buy rate in a decade since the Hogan Bischoff days. He had great matches in AAA defending that title and some fantastic matches in AEW as well, including the match with Hangman Page last weekend. So for anybody who wants to cast doubt on how important Kenny Omega has been to AEW, you would be an ignorant fool to believe otherwise. He deserves a ton of credit for going out there with his body falling apart and still having the quality of the matches that he was having. It's not just, well, I got to go out there and do a match, so I'll just sort of gut my way through it. He was going out there having top quality matches you would never even know, knew the guy was hurt. A lot of guys work hurt, but they don't all go out there and churn out great matches the way that this guy did all year. AEW now has enough names on the roster where they can afford, you know, Kenny Omega going away for a few months. He needs to go. He needs to go heal his body, or else he's going to be headed to an early retirement. And that's not going to be good for anybody, especially when they need to finish out this story eventually with Omega going babyface again. And, you know, they already laid the groundwork for a potential feud or a power struggle within the Elite when he gets back. They aired a backstage segment on Wednesday to open the show where he asked the Young Bucks to hold things down for him until he gets back. Adam Cole chimed in, though he thought he was talking to him. He chimed in and said, "Cleaner, don't worry, I got this." And it was an awkward moment between the two. Obviously, that foreshadows something more coming up next year. But that can't be true, because the social media samurais told me that AEW has no storylines. Every day I still get people tweeting me that. What's the big deal about AEW? They have no stories. It's like, they say, what's the big deal about AEW? And I go to respond, but then I see the second part of their tweet where they say they have no stories, and I just ignore them. You can't save people like that. Some people are just so, they're just so dumb. Their brain, there's just some kind of malfunction that some people just cannot be helped. If you don't believe that AEW doesn't have actual stories or storylines mixed in with all the random matches that they have, you're just not watching their television shows. I don't understand how anybody with any common sense could possibly make a comment like that. You may not like the stories they're telling, but to say they don't tell any stories, it's completely devoid of storylines, it's just a stupid comment to make. But Hangman Page is the AEW World Champion now. They had the big payoff to the chase that has lasted well over 2 years. And he is now the World Champion, and he's one of those young talents. I mean, he wasn't homegrown. He had a name already before he came in, but not at the level of a Kenny Omega or even a Cody or the Bucks. Yeah, he was lower down. He really did become a top star while working for AEW. So he's the first guy to hold that championship who you could really look at and say, this is an AEW homegrown guy. You couldn't say that about Chris Jericho. You couldn't say that about Jon Moxley. You couldn't say it about Kenny Omega, but you can say it about Hangman Page. Bryan Danielson beat Miro at Full Gear to earn the next shot at the AEW World title, and he showed up in heel mode on Dynamite, which I thought was fantastic. We got old school heel American Dragon, which I was not expecting. But if you think about it, I mean, it kind of makes sense, right? Here's what I think. I think Jon Moxley was beating Bryan Danielson at Full Gear, and he was going to get the first shot at Hangman as a heel. So if they wanted a heel against Adam Page to make sure that he is fully cheered, but not just a heel, like someone people actually think has a shot to take the championship from him, then Miro probably was not the guy. But Danielson is. And this story they're doing where Brian is promising to run through each member of the Dark Order until he gets to Page is something that very likely would have gone to Jon Moxley had he not had to bow out of the Eliminator. He already beat the hell out of Preston Vance in the first round, and I thought that was a pretty weak opponent for Moxley at the time. Maybe that was by design, and Moxley would have been the one challenging Colt Cabana in Chicago this Wednesday instead of it being Danielson. And it would have been Jon Moxley running through all of the remaining members of the Dark Order. So what they effectively did was they gave Jon Moxley's story, there's that word again, they gave Jon Moxley's story to Bryan Danielson. And then once the match happens and Hangman wins, Bryan can shake his hand. He puts him over like a champ, and he goes back to being the Bryan Danielson that he was before. I don't think this is a heel turn that's going to last longer than the Hangman match. because I don't think that was the original plan. Now, as far as when the match happens, it's got to be that first Dynamite on TBS or the first TNT special, which is, I believe, airing a few days later. If that is not a live show on January 8th, then it has to be January 5th. Whenever they do the Danielson Hangman match, it cannot be on a taped show. It has to be live. So it might be the first Dynamite on TBS. They have announced another Winter is Coming special for next month. Winter is Coming edition of Dynamite on December 15th. It was Winter is Coming last December when Kenny Omega beat Moxley to become the AEW World Champion. We got a title change on live TV. Could they do the match with Danielson and Hangman on the Winter is Coming show? I think that's too soon. I think there's a better chance of seeing a big debut on that show, like a Kyle O'Reilly, or maybe the Briscoes coming over from Ring of Honor. Tony Khan tweeted that they will be revealing more information on that show about the Owen Hart Cup, including the schedule and the start date for it. A lot of people, I'm sure, on that roster are going to want in that tournament. You probably have people knocking on Tony Khan's door backstage trying to lobby for a spot in that tournament. But they're talking about the format of the tournament being unique. It might not be a traditional 8-man or 16-man bracket. Maybe it's like a G1 kind of round robin thing. I don't know, but they're talking about the format as being something that people aren't expecting. So I'm very curious to see what they have in mind. We had an appearance by Tomohiro Ishii, the never open weight champion from New Japan Pro Wrestling, teaming with Orange Cassidy against The Butcher and The Blade. Always love seeing Ishii. This was his first appearance in an AEW ring, and the fans reacted to him in kind. They were very happy to see him. They dug his offense when he was in there with The Butcher, and they were going back and forth. Sean Ross Sapp said The Butcher has been on tour lately with his band, but he took the night off just to wrestle Ishii, and he was going to go back on tour after. But now I see that The Butcher suffered a torn bicep during the match. So he came off that tour to wrestle Ishii, and then he got hurt. So I don't know what his status is now. You know, it's tougher to heal up from those types of injuries and muscle tears when you're older. And The Butcher is 43. And he's already coming off a thumb injury that he had earlier in the year. He missed many months for that. So I don't know when we'll see The Butcher again. I guess back to the butcher shop until he's ready to come back. Nyla Rose and Hikaru Shida had a real good match in the TBS title tournament that sent Nyla to the next round to meet the winner of the match between Ruby Soho and Chris Statlander. And on Rampage, Jade Cargill beat Red Velvet in a match that was not as good as the one from Wednesday. So as I look at this tournament bracket as it now stands, Thunder Rosa wrestles Jamie Hayter this Wednesday. That's going to be a win for Thunder Rosa. Okay, and she's going to go on to wrestle Jade Cargill, of this I am sure. And my prediction is that Jade Cargill beats Thunder Rosa when Jamie Hayter and probably Rebel and maybe even Britt Baker herself cost Rosa the match as a measure of revenge for her win over Jamie Hayter this week. That also then sets the stage for Thunder Rosa, by the way, to go after Britt Baker early next year, which is what I've been advocating for. So she goes after the Women's Championship, the World Women's Championship. So Thunder Rosa is going to be just fine. So Jade goes to the finals. And on the other side of the bracket, we have Ruby and Statlander. You know, it's a tough call because they're both very good, both baby faces. So either one of them can advance and they would fit well in the spot. I think the winner of that match, though, is going to win the entire tournament. And I don't think Chris Statlander is winning this tournament. I think Ruby wins. I think she goes on to beat Nyla Rose in the next round. And then she stuns Jade Cargill in the finals to become the first TBS champion. One thing that was very apparent from her match on Rampage, Jade isn't ready to be the champion yet. She'll get there. But now is not the right time. I think Ruby is winning the belt. We got our first tease of CM Punk and MJF. MJF was interrupted by Punk. Punk never said a word. He just stood in the ring. MJF offered his hand. Punk laughed at him and walked away. So I'm very excited for the promo battles that await between CM Punk and MJF. I might be more interested in that than the match itself, and I think the match itself will be very good. But this is the Punk feud that I've been waiting for. I just didn't know that they were going to go to it this quickly. And it makes me wonder, if you remember when Tony Khan got photographed and he was holding that paper, he was at the Jaguars game, and it looked like he had sketched out a rough draft of the Full Gear card. The match that was listed on that sketch for CM Punk was CM Punk against Wardlow. It did not say CM Punk against Eddie Kingston, which is what we ended up getting. So I wonder, as they begin the tease for Punk and MJF, which is still, it's got to be a ways off from happening. You know, again, maybe that first TBS show, maybe not even until Revolution in February. But in the meantime, maybe we will get that Punk-Wardlow match. Maybe that was the idea originally, that they would do it at Full Gear and it would build to Punk and MJF. I think we'll get Punk and Wardlow before we get that match. And I also think that MJF should be the first person to hand CM Punk a loss in AEW. When they do ultimately meet, I think MJF should go over in that match. Main event on Wednesday was Sammy Guevara and Jay Lethal for the TNT Championship. They had a hell of a match. It was a hell of a main event. Sammy has just looked fantastic on television recently. I even made the comment on Wednesday, physically, it looks like he's, you know, put a little bit of muscle on, you know, bulking up a little bit. So, you know, one day he'll move on to bigger and better things. But right now he's kind of killing it with that TNT title. Jay Lethal loses in his first match, but it was a hell of a match. I was not a big fan of that Rampage show on Friday night. And the AEW drones did not like hearing that. Oh, let me tell you, they did not like hearing that. They are every bit as insufferable as the WWE fanatics are. I don't care what anybody says. They are every bit as bad as the WWE drones. Actually, I think they might be worse. Get a load of this tweet that I got. I won't mention the person's name. I will spare them the embarrassment and the shame. But I could not believe this when I read this. This is what this person sent me. AEW is at the stage right now where they have earned the right to have nothing but positive comments. They have done enough where I really don't think you can make negative comments. Are you out of your fucking mind? First of all, don't tell me what I can and cannot say on my own Twitter page, because that's just obnoxious. I may not agree with what you say on your page, but I cannot imagine ever seeking someone out and telling them you can't say something on your own page. I mean, what a ridiculous, asinine idea. And equally asinine is the idea that because AEW has built up all of this goodwill with its audience, and they have, I trust in Tony Khan the way that I trusted in Lucha Underground. I trust in Tony Khan the way that I trusted in Triple H and his booking for a very long time, in the glory days of NXT, because they had earned the benefit of the doubt on a lot of things, because at least the booking and a lot of what they did made sense more often than not. And with AEW, they've earned the benefit of the doubt on a lot of things because they don't treat their fans like idiots the way that WWE does. WWE thinks you are a moron. I don't get that sense when I watch AEW, or really any other company, that they hate their fans and think their fans are stupid the way that WWE does. So when someone says, let it play out, right? Even if I might be unsure of something that AEW is doing, because I don't like all the, you know, the storylines and stuff that they do all the time, but I'm more likely to say, okay, you know what? I'll give them a little more latitude than I would WWE, because usually when things play out there, I end up even more exasperated than I was to begin with. And that is generally not the case with AEW so far. But to say that they should only get positive comments and you really can't say anything negative, I mean, how toxic must the air be that fills your head to say something like that? If I gave out an award each week for dumb tweet, I would frame this one and hang it up on my wall. All for a tweet that I posted saying that I thought Billy Gunn kicking out of that first coffin drop by Darby Allin on Friday night, kicking out at one, was a fail. I understand the story they were trying to tell. But Billy, in the match, he smacked his face. He went for a stinger splash, and he smacked his face on top of the ring post, on top of the camera. There's a camera mounted on top of the ring post. And he knocked himself silly. And then Darby hit a couple of moves before he went up for the coffin drop. If Darby hits his finish, even if Billy is bigger than him. Yes, I understand Billy Gunn is probably taking shits bigger than Darby Allin. I get that. You don't have to tell me for the 1,000th time. I can see it with my own 2 eyes. Thank you very much. Even if that's the case, Billy Gunn should not be kicking out of the man's finish in that circumstance. That's my opinion. But that's all I said. That was the tweet. I didn't like it. It was a fail. Apparently, you're not allowed to say anything negative about AEW, though. They have earned the right that they only get positive comments. You are not allowed to say anything negative about the company. Not only will I say negative things when I feel like they are warranted, I'm going to continue to call out stupid shit like this on my show, just to illustrate that there are fans on both sides who belong in a psych ward. I did like the main event, so that should make that person very happy. Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus picked up a win over Adam Cole and Bobby Fish. Adam Cole left Bobby Fish out to dry at the end when he got... he and the Bucks, who had walked out to the ring, they got chased up the ramp by Christian Cage in a steel chair. Adam Cole may not have helped Bobby Fish, but there's another man I could think of who I'm sure would be very happy to help Bobby Fish. He's a free agent in a few weeks. Won't be much longer before we get that Red Dragon reunion. There was a joint press conference at midnight Eastern time on Friday night with New Japan Pro Wrestling and Pro Wrestling Noah to announce that the two promotions will be working together for night 3 of Wrestle Kingdom on January 8th for what they are calling New Japan versus Pro Wrestling Noah at the Yokohama Arena. Usually Wrestle Kingdom is back-to-back nights at the Tokyo Dome, January 4th and 5th. And it will be again, but this time they're doing a third night in a smaller building on the 8th. And now we know what it is going to be. And the event is going to be airing live on pay-per-view in Japanese and in English. And it will be made available a week later on demand on New Japan World. It's going to be a mix of matches with New Japan stars wrestling Noah stars and New Japan stars teaming with stars from Noah. No matches have been announced yet, but the poster features Okada, Tanahashi, and the IWGP Heavyweight Champion Shingo Takagi on the New Japan side. And on the Noah side, we have Katsuhiko Nakajima, who is the reigning GHC Heavyweight Champion, Kaito Kiyomiya, and Keiji Muto, the Great Muta. I guess Tony Khan is not the only one holding the forbidden door open. I'm a novice when it comes to sports betting, but I'm learning all the time. If you are like me, and you always feel like the last one out when it comes to betting, or you just don't know where to begin, I have got the show for you. Understand where the market is moving, which smart bets are out there, and have some fun listening to BetQL Daily, presented by FanDuel, the must-listen show for sports bettors and sports fans alike. Host Joe Ostrowski, Joe Giglio, and Aaron Hawksworth are great together. It's the right mix of sports talk with the betting insights that you need every week, Monday through Friday. They're very entertaining, and it's an easy listen for me, you know, during the day when I'm working. It's been a great way for me to pass the time and also pick up on some things I didn't know about before. Find out where the market is moving across all of the week's biggest sporting events. And if you ever miss out on earlier games, they've got you covered there too, with recaps from some of the biggest moments in sports. If you're not sure where to start with sports betting, start with BetQL Daily, presented by FanDuel. Listen weekdays 9 a.m. to noon Eastern on Odyssey, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. WrestleVotes on Tuesday tweeted that the idea of NXT moving from TVPG to TV14 is still an idea that is very much on the table, and USA Network is not opposed to it. It's already been a TV14 show for weeks now, I don't care what the little black box in the corner of the screen says. And it's not made the show any better. If anything, the show is worse. Good television, interesting characters, great action. That is what is going to make the show must-see. Not the rating. And even that doesn't matter at this point, because all I see when I watch NXT now are dead people. Like the kid from The Sixth Sense. All I see are a bunch of people that are going to be swept up in a wave of mass releases in the next 12 months. So what are we even doing here? I mean, this just feels like a gigantic waste of time. You know, this is the problem when it comes to all these people getting cut. How are you supposed to get invested in any of these people and want to see where they're going to go? Oh, I can't wait. Boy, I like this character. This Tony D'Angelo guy, man. He's really entertaining. Forget about it. Oh, man, I can't wait to see where this guy goes. We know where this guy is going. We know where this guy is going. This guy's going to get whacked in a matter of months. And that's going to be the end of Tony D'Angelo. This week's show ended with a challenge being laid down for the Women's War Games match on December 5th. I've got some thoughts on who the final woman in the match might be and where I think they're going to be going with the men's War Games match. First, though, when I'm right, I'm right. PW Insider reported this week that NXT has quietly dropped the Mei Ying character from television, which was played by the former Karen Q, and instead her new name will be Wendy Chu. As in C-H-O-O, that's how it's spelled, like Choo Choo Train. I told you this Tian Sha thing was dead in the water. The minute they called up Xia Li to the main roster, it was already on life support, even before that. Now it's official. That's probably bad news for Boa, come the next round of releases. The story was, it was interesting at first, and I did see the vignette they did for Xia Li on SmackDown this week, and it was very well done. It was done like a comic book. And they gave her a backstory and everything. Again, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The only thing that might save Xia Li on SmackDown is the fact that the reason she was called up, allegedly, is because they want to have a Chinese superstar on television. And China is, I mean, everybody is trying to break into China in a big way. I mean, China's big business. So if WWE wants to make nice with China, then I can see that saving Xia Li. Outside of that, you know, as great as the vignette was that they aired on Friday night, who cares? Who cares? How many more people are they going to debut on television and fire them within a month or two? That's what I mean. It's hard to even care. But it was a well-done vignette. But the reason I bring it up is, if you remember, the earlier vignettes for this whole Tian Sha thing were also done in a similar kind of way. They were animated. And it was something unlike anything we had really seen on WWE television, hence why I thought it was so unique and so interesting. And it just went on for so long. And it went nowhere. And once Triple H got sick, that was the final nail in its coffin. So that is one storyline I will not miss, because it wasn't progressing. It wasn't going anywhere. Some observations from this week's show. I'm going to bounce around a little bit here. Let's talk about some of the stuff that caught my eye. Tony D'Angelo picked up his biggest win to date over Dexter Lumis before Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams ran out to lay a beatdown on Lumis and they pilmanized his hand. Johnny Gargano came out to clear out the heels and vowed to go after Carmelo, but was interrupted by Pete Dunne, who actually did pin Carmelo Hayes the week before. Hayes challenged both men to a triple threat match for his North American Championship. That match takes place this Tuesday, and I think given who's involved, it should be excellent. We know Gargano's credentials, and we know how good Pete Dunne is, but Carmelo Hayes has also been very impressive since he first showed up on NXT. On the subject of Johnny Gargano, per this week's Observer, he still has not signed a new contract with the company. His current deal is set to expire on December 3rd, which is coming up pretty quick. WWE is pushing hard for him to re-sign and made a strong offer, rather, for him to stay. All I can say is that if you work for that company and you are not named Roman Reigns or Brock Lesnar and you see all of the carnage that has gone down this year alone, this week alone, let alone this year alone, especially on the NXT side and the way they have savaged NXT, and you still sign a long-term contract with this company, you get what you pay for. Meltzer did make a most unfortunate typo right after this when he wrote that Kyle O'Reilly also has his death coming up soon. I assume he meant date. I mean, he's been suffering a slow death these past few months, so I can't blame him. It's an obvious mistake. But poor Kyle. I mean, first they pair him up with Von Wagner, and now he's got Meltzer spoiling his own death. Last week, I said the only thing that had thankfully changed about Cameron Grimes was it looked like he trimmed his chest hair. I try not to pay too much attention to people's body hair, but that was the only noticeable change I could detect. And I thought, you know, the reports of him cutting his hair and losing the beard because Vince McMahon supposedly wanted him to change his look before he would even consider looking at him for the main roster. I mean, if that's the case, if Vince McMahon is basically saying, I won't look at this guy for the main roster unless he cuts his hair and trims his beard, I want Cameron Grimes to grow that fucking thing like ZZ Top. I want his hair to be down to the fucking ground, dragging it around. He has to reach down and pick up his hair like a bride on her wedding day picks up her dress, if it'll keep him away from that main roster. Anyway, I spoke too soon. Grimes had a poker showdown this week with Duke Hudson, whose gimmick is that he's supposed to be this master poker player, but yet he plays like shit. I don't know if that's supposed to be part of the gimmick or not, but it is. They had this long poker table in the ring with the ring announcer Alicia Taylor in the ring to explain the rules. It was a game of no limit Texas Hold'em. I know next to nothing about poker, so this was all gibberish to me. I used to have one of those electronic pocket poker games. I know you want to try to get a royal flush, which was impossible, so I would always shoot for three of a kind or four of a kind. That's the extent of my poker knowledge. Grimes kept drawing bad cards, but he played it cool. He totally bluffed Hudson, who thought Grimes' cards were better than they actually were. He got played by him once before, and he thought he was being played again. And he flew into a rage, and when he realized that he did get played again, he flew into a rage, he attacked Grimes, he powerbombed him through the poker table, and then he pulls out a toolbox from under the ring, and he grabs a hammer. But he thinks better of it, and he looks down, and instead in the toolbox, he finds a pair of scissors that just so happened to be inside this toolbox. I know I've had toolboxes before. Can't say that I've ever found a pair of scissors inside one. But I guess they're just really prepared for anything down there. He climbs back into the ring and he proceeds to trim off part of Grimes' beard and he cut off chunks of his hair. He didn't shave him bald or anything, but it was enough that it may be noticeable on TV this week. The best I can say about this is that the segment held my attention, which is more than I can say for a lot of the stuff I saw on the show this week. I don't see a long shelf life for the poker gimmick. I mean, Duke Hudson just debuted this gimmick, and he has already had two poker game segments. One was a pre-tape with Grimes, and then they did one in the ring. So where does he go from here? I mean, is he going to do this with every single person he feuds with? Probably not. And that's a good thing. Him not being saddled long-term with this gimmick. Kyle O'Reilly and Von Wagner got a win over Brooks and Jensen. I like Berkeley and Jensen better, myself. I shop there all the time. I look forward to the Undisputed reunion soon with Fish and O'Reilly. This tag team stuff with Von Wagner sucks. Persia Parada won a handicap match all by herself over Gabby Stevens and Jenna Levy. Actually wrote their names down. This after she told her partner Indy Hartwell not to worry about their match. Go be with your husband. He was being tended to for that hand injury I mentioned at the beginning of the show. Robert Stone was out there watching Parada's match with great interest. And if I'm Persia Parada, I am keeping far, far away from that man. All but one of the women that he has been associated with are gone from the company. Chelsea Green was part of the Robert Stone brand. Gone. Jesse Kamea was part of the Robert Stone brand. Gone. Mercedes Martinez was briefly part of the Robert Stone brand. Gone. Frankie Monet, not officially a member, but she was hanging out around him. Gone. Of all the women that he has worked with, Aaliyah is the last one standing. Imagine that. And she's the one who spent the longest time there, too, in developmental. 6 years. They've already started teasing a rematch between Tommaso Ciampa and Bron Breakker for the NXT Championship. Ciampa cut a heated promo on all of the young punks in the NXT locker room when he was interrupted by Breakker, who vowed to take the title from him. I like how Ciampa spoofed the Scott Steiner math promo with his response. He gave Bron a 33.5% chance of taking the title from him. And then he walked off. Now, they could be setting up for a title match on that live special in a few weeks. I see them as part of War Games, which I'll get to in a second. Raquel Gonzalez and Dakota Kai headlined the show. It was more of an angle to set up the women's War Games match than any kind of real blow-off between these two. Kai, at the end, brought the shovel into the ring that she used to cost Raquel the title at Halloween Havoc. But Gonzalez got a hold of it, and before she could use it, Toxic Attraction attacked for the DQ finish. Cora Jade ran in to make the save. She was hitting people with her skateboard. And then Zoe Stark walked out on crutches after her recent ACL surgery to introduce Io Shirai, her tag team partner, and Stark handed one of her crutches to Io. There's some symbolism there with her going away for a while. It was like she was handing off the baton to her partner. We got a brawl. Finally, we had Io screaming, "War Games!" into the microphone. I still say it the way William Regal does, you know. "War Games!" Doesn't quite pack the same punch that Regal did when he would say it. So War Games on the female side looks to be the three members of Toxic Attraction and Dakota Kai against Io Shirai, Raquel Gonzalez, Cora Jade, and I am thinking the last spot probably goes to Kaylee Ray, who just came over from NXT UK, and they've been airing vignettes for her, and she had one or two squash matches on TV. She's brushed past Toxic Attraction on her way to the ring a few times on TV. So I'm thinking that last spot is going to go to her. The men's side is a little bit harder to predict, but I see it as Ciampa, Gargano, Pete Dunne, and probably LA Knight against Bron Breakker, Carmelo Hayes, Grayson Waller, I think will be one of them, and maybe Solo Sikoa. It would be weird seeing Breakker on the team since it looks like the idea is going to be to have the veterans as the babyfaces and the new blood as the heels. Even Waller in his appearance on Lash Legends show is acting heelish. He was putting down indie wrestlers. Breakker doesn't really fit in there. So, I mean, maybe instead of LA Knight, he joins with the vets and they build more tension with him and Ciampa working on the same team, possibly. You know, then they would have two more spots to fill on the New Blood side. But that's what it looks like to me. The battle between NXT 1.0 and NXT 2.0. Although it really wasn't NXT 1.0. It was at least NXT 1.5. But to make things easier, we'll go with 1.0. And that's your NXT report. If you have questions for the mailbag, and I know you do, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Feed me more. And when you do, make sure you include your name and where you are from. I had intended to get to some of these questions on the anniversary show on Thursday before WWE fucked everything up. And we ended up going 3.5 hours doing Survivor Series predictions and then talking about all the people who just lost their jobs. But we also answered a shitload of Super Chat questions. And thank you, by the way. You blew me away with your support on Thursday. But I did want to get to these email questions. We got some good ones in here. Chase from Verona, Wisconsin. Could Jay Lethal's signing be used as a way for an invasion of some kind by some of the ROH roster? Maybe four other people come in and beat down Sammy and the rest of the Inner Circle. Could have the Briscoes, Flip Gordon, and another guy show up to help beat down the Inner Circle. Could lead maybe to final battle. End the ROH as we know it with a major 5-on-5 battle. I believe Chase sent that in before Lethal had his match with Sammy on Dynamite. I mean, it's an interesting idea. I think the whole concept of these invasions has sort of jumped the shark, and a lot of people just don't do them the right way. But the idea that AEW has absolutely no incentive to help Ring of Honor. So I don't know why AEW would send anybody to Ring of Honor to be on their pay-per-view. So no, I don't see that happening. I don't think it needs to. You know, we already saw Lethal on Wednesday. He had a great match with Sammy. It looks like he's going to be doing his own thing. I think the Briscoes coming in absolutely should happen. I think it will happen. But do they need to come in as part of some kind of invasion? I don't think it's necessary. My man, Rodimus Prime, dropping an email question. What would you think of a potential G1 climax where half the field is New Japan and the other half is AEW? And if it happens, who from AEW would you put in the tournament not named Punk or Danielson? Well, first of all, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. AEW is not sending 4, 5, 6 or more of its talent to Japan for a G1. That is a grueling schedule. And Tony Khan, it's one thing if you have one person, or even two, who go over there to do a one-shot or a brief tour or something. They can't afford to lose that many people at once. They'd have to travel. They might have to quarantine, whatever the restrictions are at that time. So it's not practical. But let's entertain the thought. Who would I include from the AEW roster, not named Bryan Danielson or CM Punk? I mean, I think Kenny Omega is an obvious one. Andrade would be a great fit for the G1. Malakai Black. I think Miro. I think Pac would be great. And I'll throw Penta out there. I think Pentagon would also be good for a spot in the G1. Buford from Memphis, Tennessee. Has John Cena passed Stone Cold Steve Austin in popularity and in pop culture? That is an interesting question. Pop culture, yes. Yes, he has. Popularity is a subjective thing, because what do you mean by that? Are you talking about popularity in pop culture, or are we talking popularity in pro wrestling? You could say yes, but you could also say no. Are we talking about them in their respective kind of glory periods? What years would that be? For Austin, we know that that's pretty much 97 to 2001, let's say, even though he went on a little bit longer. For Cena, are we talking? I mean, what are we talking about? Cena had a much longer run than Austin did, but at no point in John Cena's popularity did he have that brief period that Austin had. I mean, it was brief. I mean, Austin really was white hot for about 2 years, maybe 2.5. John Cena had a 15-plus year run that Austin never had because his neck and his knees, it didn't allow him to have that kind of run, and he had to retire when I think he was 38. So we're talking about two very different types of careers, but when Austin was white hot at his peak, there has never been anybody in the history of that company, and I'll throw Hogan in there as well, who at their peak was as white hot as Austin was when he got hot in the late 90s. So the popularity thing, I'm a little uneasy answering that because, you know, that can mean so many different things. Current day pop culture, yeah, John Cena is a bigger star than Steve Austin is. And there's more people, when you say the name John Cena, who are going to know who that is than would if you said Steve Austin or Stone Cold Steve Austin. Carlos from New York, what do you think it would take for WWE to revert back to a wrestling-centric product like NXT under Triple H? I mean, look, WWE has, it's not as if they don't have any really great wrestling matches on television or on some of their pay-per-views. NXT was more wrestling-centric. The issue is not everything needs to be wrestling-centric. I'm fine with having interesting characters and stories that don't, it's not always about the moves and the matches and stuff. I just want to have fun and be entertained. And WWE just does a very poor job of that right now. That's really what it boils down to. I don't want WWE to necessarily be the way that NXT was, where it's just about the matches, you know, between the indie guys. I never said that that's what I wanted. I just want them to put a product out that is interesting. We get some great wrestling matches out of it. Great. That's a bonus. But WWE has never been just about wrestling. They've never been a wrestling-centric product. That's just never been them. So I don't know why you think all of a sudden they would change. I mean, it worked for NXT. I don't know that that would work for WWE. The problem is that the brand of sports entertainment that WWE gives us a lot of the time sucks. You can do sports entertainment. At least be good at it, though, if you're going to do it. Don't make it shitty and boring. Ruby from Sacramento. I read an old article in The Observer, and it says that if Stone Cold Steve Austin did not have neck surgery, and that the plan was for Austin to win the title of the Royal Rumble from Triple H, and then turn heel, which would lead to Austin against The Rock for the title of WrestleMania 16, with Rock going over and becoming the new top babyface in the company. Do you think this would have been a good idea? That is the first I'm hearing of that as the actual plan. Is it possible maybe he was just talking about what he thought might happen? Because I've never heard anything about that being the plan. If that was the plan, I think the idea of it in theory was nice, that they would have Austin put Rock over, because he never did, except WrestleMania 19 when his career was already over. He finally, you know, got pinned by The Rock clean in the middle of the ring. But I think it would have been a fail, because, look, we talk about what a poor idea it was turning Austin heel in 2001. It would have been even worse turning him heel in 2000. There was still a lot of juice left in Steve Austin as the babyface. People did not want to boo him. He was still the golden goose. So no, I don't think it would have been a good idea to turn him heel in 2000. I think it would have been every bit as bad as it was in 2001. Joe from Nashville, Tennessee. Had Mr. Perfect not left WWE soon after he helped Triple H win the Intercontinental title, and had he stayed on as Triple H's advisor, do you think China would have been brought in to be in his corner in 1997? I don't. Luis Cannon Lopez has a buy or sell, buy, sell, or rent on Bret Hart's best matches from Madison Square Garden. Mr. Perfect, SummerSlam 91, Owen Hart, WrestleMania 10, or Stone Cold Steve Austin, Survivor Series 1996, which I just talked about a little earlier. I would buy on WrestleMania 10 against Owen. I would rent on SummerSlam, and I would sell on Survivor Series. But all three are classic matches that if you have never seen, you owe it to yourself to go sit down and take notes on what real wrestling looks like. Nathan from London, I have a question on the Natural Born Thrillers from WCW. Do you think their ceiling could have been much higher? I always found them so impressive. They were athletic, good workers. Mike Sanders was a good talker. Sean O'Hare and Chuck Palumbo were agile. Sean Stasiak started to get better. They were one of the shining lights near the end for WCW. When people talk about the potential of a young faction like the Nexus, I think the Natural Born Thrillers had more potential. If WCW did not get purchased by WWE, do you think their ceiling could have been higher? Their ceiling went about as high as it was going to go in those days, I think, in WCW. I remember Mike Sanders being a pretty charismatic guy, pretty good talker. I don't remember too much about his ring work. Palumbo and O'Hare were always talked about as one of the young up-and-coming teams. So yeah, I mean, I think their ceiling was higher, but I don't know that it's as high as you are thinking of it. I think individually, I think someone like O'Hare could have been much higher than he was. Mike Sanders could have been too. I don't know actually why he never went to, unless he was in WWE. Maybe he was. Maybe he did sign. Or maybe his contract carried over. They certainly didn't do anything with him if Sanders did go to WWE, but I don't remember offhand if he ever went. And if not, I wonder why. Because I do think he had potential. Sufi from Malaysia has two questions on WWE titles. What was the original purpose of the European Championship? Why was the title created in the first place? And why was the Intercontinental title briefly unified with the World Heavyweight title in 2002, only to be resurrected months later? I am not entirely sure, but WWE was very popular in Europe at that time, so I always thought it had more to do with that than anything else. You know, Bulldog was a natural pick for the first champion, but the company was very popular in the UK, very popular in Germany at the time, probably other places as well. So I think that had a lot to do with it. As for the IC title, I think that was just a way to make Triple H an even stronger champ. It was all about making Triple H strong and keeping him strong. So I think him absorbing this additional championship was just a way to do that. And I think it was about 6 or 7 months later they realized the error of their ways, that they needed a mid-card title, and so they brought it back. They never should have unified the two to begin with. That was a very, very stupid idea. And at the time, a lot of people said it was a stupid idea. Molly from Toronto, who do you think is the best wrestler turned actor? What he means is acting-wise and versatility, not just popular names. But who is the best from John Cena, Dave Bautista, and Dwayne Johnson? Bautista is very good. I think Bautista has the potential to end up being a very, very good actor, even better than he is now. And I've seen some of the lesser films that he's done, Bushwick. There was another one, is it Land of the Rising Sun might have been. Those weren't great movies, but I thought he was good in them, but he's not as versatile as The Rock or John Cena. Not yet, anyway. So it really boils down to Rock or Cena. Cena's very good. Rock has done action films. He's done comedies. Versatility. You know what? Honestly, I put them on the same level. We've seen Rock. What was it? Be Cool. He had a role many, many years ago, early in his acting career, in Be Cool. He's played those characters like that you wouldn't expect him to play. Cena has done that also. I'm just trying to think if I really think one is that much stronger than the other. I probably would go Rock, but barely. I think in terms of their versatility, I think they're pretty even. Tori from Atlanta, how would you rate the careers of Sheamus, Dolph Ziggler, and Cesaro? What do you think gives them their longevity in their WWE careers? I think that someone like a Dolph Ziggler is kept around because they just think he's useful. That's the thing. If you outlive your usefulness, they'll get rid of you. Dolph Ziggler, they can just plug in wherever they need him. It could be in a tag team. It could be in a singles feud. And he keeps his mouth shut. We were talking about Top Dollar earlier, right? Calling the office. Why'd you fire B-Fab? Or, hey, turn the audio down in the segment. It's a little too high. And if they think you're a giant pain in the ass, and they think you should just keep your mouth shut and do what you're told, Dolph Ziggler, it seems like he keeps his mouth shut and does what he's told. And all the people on the internet are the ones who always say, oh man, they're wasting Ziggler. Oh man, all the potential that Dolph Ziggler had. And yet, what did Dolph Ziggler do time and time again? His contract would come due, he would re-sign with the company. His contract would come due, he would re-sign with the company. He has outside interests. He's got a little comedy career for himself. I think he's just content where he is, and he doesn't do anything or say anything to rock the boat. And that's exactly what WWE loves. They love people who just keep their mouth shut, do what they're told, and don't rock the boat, and don't cause headaches. I think that, as much as anything, has to do with how Ziggler has stuck around as long as he has. Cesaro, I think they recognize that he's a quality talent. They just don't see him at a top level. Sheamus? Sheamus is great. I think Sheamus is, he has been a hero for them. Over the pandemic era into this year, the matches he's had, he's another one. You could just plug him in wherever you need him. He's done the tag team thing. He's done the singles thing. Now There's this pairing with him and Ridge Holland. They're going to use him to try to get Ridge Holland over on TV. Sheamus looks the part. He's got size. He's a brawler. He's got a unique look to him. I think they like that about him. And as far as rating their careers, they've all had varying levels of success. I mean, Sheamus has been very successful. He's held almost every championship there is to hold except the Universal and the IC. He's won King of the Rings. He's won Royal Rumbles. He's done it all. I think he's had an excellent career. Dolph Ziggler has also had a very good career, but it's a career that people are going to look back on and say, he could have been a little bit higher than he was. Cesaro, people are going to look at and say he should have been a lot higher than he was. He's had a good run. Cesaro should have had a great run. A lot of wasted potential with Cesaro. Hugh Jazz from, love that name, from California. You get a lot of those in California? How would you have booked the ending of Starrcade 97 in the ensuing months for Sting and the NWO? So I gave a little bit of thought to this. First of all, the main thing is no bullshit at Starrcade 97. Sting wins cleanly. Then he wins the rematch, as he did at Super Brawl. At that point, his business with Hogan is done. You can still do the NWO Civil War that they, you know, teased. You could do that for a little while. But at that point, you start using the NWO to shift focus to the young stars on the rise and make them bigger. Make new stars using their existing ones. Like what Randy Savage did for DDP. But you do it with Jericho and with Guerrero and with Benoit. You keep building Goldberg the way that they were. Keep building him. But he shouldn't have been the only one that they were building. He was the only one with the undefeated streak. He was going to be, you know, the red hot star. But you could still build all of these other people who can work matches longer than 3 fucking minutes. Because for every card that's going to have a 4-minute Goldberg match, you're going to need a 15-minute Chris Jericho or Eddie Guerrero match to round out the card or open the show really hot. Maybe a cruiserweight match. Ray is in there with Juventud or something. You need those guys. So keep building them up. You could have gotten a year out of Sting as the champion with him putting over Goldberg at the end of the year at Starrcade. Maybe even have Starrcade in a big dome. Put that in the Georgia Dome instead of Nitro. And, you know, I get that the Wolfpack stuff was over, the whole red and black thing. Sting never should have picked sides. Sting always, it just felt wrong, Sting joining any faction of the NWO. He never should have joined the NWO. And I know Goldberg against Hogan was huge for WCW, but they blew through everything without making any other new stars. And that just wasn't sustainable. That's why guys started jumping to WWE. They saw the writing on the wall. They got tired. Jericho said, I'm out of here. Big Show said, I'm out of here. This place is a sinking ship. And the writing on the wall was written in the blood of WCW. You don't make new stars, you don't survive. Unless, of course, you got a big fat TV contract and you got the Saudi prince in your back pocket. Then you make money hand over fist and it almost doesn't even matter what you do. Maybe Vince McMahon is a genius after all. He figured out how to make money in spite of himself. He's the smartest man in the world. Anyway, keep emailing me. Good mailbag this week. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter @Solemonster if you are not following me. Subscribe on YouTube. Solemonster Sounds Off is the channel, man. If you are not on YouTube, you are missing out. Whether you are just a subscriber or if you want to become a paying channel member, we have some perks and extra content for our channel members as well. Whatever it may be, if you are not on the YouTube channel, you are missing out. So you need to subscribe, and that way you will be notified when I go live. You will be notified when new clips go up. So head on over to YouTube and show your love on there. I want to wish every single person listening to this right now who can hear me, everybody within the sound of my voice, I want to wish them, if you are celebrating, a very happy Thanksgiving this week. I am thankful for all of you. I am thankful for 14 years of this podcast and the fact that even through all the bullshit, I still have fun doing what I do. And I'm glad that you keep tuning in to listen to me rant and rave like a maniac about all these things. And Anyway, we are going to be back with episode 732. That'll be next Sunday. Of course, Survivor Series is tonight. You guys know the drill. I'll be on YouTube Live when the pay-per-view is over, so I expect to see many of you in the chat. Be well, stay safe, enjoy your turkey and your gravy and your stuffing and your pie. I love pie. I'm going to have me some pie this week. In fact, I might have pie more than once. And you should too. Have some pie on me. And I will see you guys for 732 next weekend. Until then, happy Thanksgiving.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Keith Lee, called up to the main roster as Keith Lee, beat Randy Orton as Keith Lee. He was in the Royal Rumble as Keith Lee. He was at the Survivor Series as Keith Lee. All of a sudden one day, we'll put claws on his tights. I'll make him scream and squeal when he goes down to the ring, and I'll make him scratch himself and lick his own ass. I'm a Bearcat.
Oh, it's a Keith Lee tribute to Bearcat Wright.
It was nonsense from the moment I fucking heard it. Give me a fucking break.
The Solomonster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster sounds off.